You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, you've heard the headlines. Millennials have ruined cereal, the dinner date, and movies. But our guest says there's a long history behind the misguided ideas of millennial bashers.
First, for Wisconsinites who live outside the big cities like Milwaukee and Madison, internet access can be frustratingly slow. This is especially true for people who live and work in more rural parts of the state. And in our high-tech world, having access to high-speed internet is quickly shifting from being a luxury to a necessity.
And state lawmakers are trying to close that gap in rural areas through the Rural Wisconsin Initiative. And it was recently announced that Wisconsin would pilot a new high-speed internet program through Microsoft. We're joined now by two members of the Wisconsin Rural Initiative. Representative Romaine Quinn is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 75th Assembly District, which includes Rice Lake. Representative Quinn, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Representative Mary Felskowski is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 35th Assembly District, which includes Irma. Representative Felskowski, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having us on.
And Representative Felskowski, you're a lifelong resident of Lincoln County. How big of a concern for your constituents is access to good internet, to high-speed internet?
It's very much a concern. One of the biggest things that I hear repeatedly is that people, you know, would like to work from their home or with their children as far as doing school projects and a lot of other things that are necessity by having a good internet connection. And that is something that is very sketchy up in our area as of now.
Do people congregate in cafes, or where do they go when they can't get it at home?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the library is instrumental, but I know you will see people like maybe parked outside of certain areas where they know there's a Wi-Fi connection, you know, with the kids, or they'll bring the kids back into the school system at night, or even people will, you know, come into town, they'll go to some of the wireless cafes or any pretty much anywhere that they can get a Wi-Fi connection.
Representative Quinn, does this echo the concerns you're having in the 75th Assembly District?
Absolutely. And I think Mary nailed the important parts of this. It's a healthcare issue. It's an economic driver issue. And it's an educational piece, too. So everything that we do in life now, it kind of involves around having internet access, whether we want to use it or not. And it's important for every member of our district, regardless of age, income, and regardless of the issue. I mean, just talk about healthcare. Telemedicine is going to be huge in the future. And how can you do that when you don't have access at home for that connection?
Representative Felskowski, what do we know about how access to broadband compares for Wisconsinites in rural areas versus people living in urban places and suburban areas on the outskirts of metro areas?
You know, it's interesting. As we've traveled around the state and as I've talked to different people, I'm surprised at where we lose pockets of internet coverage where you'd actually think. Even Speaker Voss, who lives down in the Burlington area, has a dead spot around his house and has to use, you know, a dish instead of having the internet, the fiber optic connection, and the availability. So this is not a northern problem or a western problem. It's actually a statewide problem. And it is a lot different, and it's a lot different for our constituents. As Romaine had said, when it comes to telemedicine, when it comes to safety issues, I mean, there's areas that if you hit a deer out in rural Wisconsin, you're going to sit there because you can't call 911. You can't call in if somebody's injured or whatever. So there's a very large difference.
Representative Quinn, what do we know about the economic impact of this issue?
It's huge. I mean, even the farmer down the road now is constantly watching commodity prices. I mean, it affects everyone, and especially business parks. If you don't have a business park that is wired to high-speed internet with a large bandwidth and capacity for users, you are not going to have businesses move there, plain and simple. And I know there's that need in business parks across rural areas, even in my district. So, you know, my district centers around Rice Lake, but there are other communities that are developing these business parks. And if you don't have that connection, good luck on attraction. So that's the piece where the economic piece is still very important as well.
Representative Felskowski, critics of government grants say the money is being spent on obsolete internet speeds. What do we know about this issue?
Well, one of the things that I think we all have to realize is the way technology goes, and I mean, we all know this, technology changes so fast that what I buy today could be obsolete in 2 to 3 weeks. But we're still, no matter what we do, we're going to need a certain amount of cable and fiber optics. I mean, there's a lot of things that we'll be able to do, and I know you heard with Microsoft's release that there's a bandwidth of, you know, white noise that television isn't using and other things isn't using that we could utilize, and that will come. But we're still going to need some form of fiber optics and cable that's laid. So I don't. When we change technology, you know, I buy a server for my insurance agency today. 6 months, it's obsolete, but I still need that today. We need to take the steps to get us there.
Representative Quinn, Microsoft recently announced its new rural airband initiative, and Wisconsin is one of a dozen states that will be a part of the project over the next year. How did Wisconsin become part of this pilot project?
Well, I think in going even back in that last question, if you look at our grant program, about 90%+ of the projects we've awarded to offer gig service, and I don't think that's anywhere near obsolete yet. The Microsoft issue, well, one, it helps that the CEO is from Appleton, so that helps. And I think part of it, too, is that we've had so much conversation, so much awareness, so much discussion on broadband now because we've been pushing it through our Rural Wisconsin Initiative. You know, I think companies look to us and say, okay, Wisconsin is getting serious about this issue, and maybe they'd be a partner at the table. And I just want to reiterate, we absolutely are. As chair of the Science and Technology Committee, we will bend over backwards to develop these partnerships, to develop new technologies, to get this access to people all across Wisconsin.
We're talking right now with Representative Romaine Quinn. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 75th Assembly District. And we're talking with Representative Mary Felskowski, who is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 35th Assembly District, discussing high-speed internet across the state, broadband issues, and what the Rural Wisconsin Initiative wants to do about it. Representative Quinn, going more deeply into the Microsoft proposal, what are they trying to do?
Yeah, and I think Representative Felskowski touched on that. Basically, using those unused white noise kind of type channels that you have on your TV sets that aren't being used, and trying to find and develop a technology to run internet through there. So we're not sure specifically how it'll work in terms of how do you access that once it gets into the home. But that technology is coming. And Microsoft, I hear, is not looking to provide the broadband and get into the business of it, but they're willing to share their patents with those that do provide it. So you're looking at, you know, the AT&T, Verizons, and other providers of the world. And, I mean, this is huge. So you think, remember Grandma and Grandpa having that antenna to get a handful of stations for TV. Can you imagine them having high-speed internet access through that same the tools they've been using forever just to get a couple of TV channels? So this could totally revolutionize internet access for rural communities across the country, not even Wisconsin.
As part of this project, does Wisconsin have to invest in this as well as a condition of participating?
That we are not aware of yet. They're choosing Wisconsin as a pilot, but like I said, we are more than willing to work with, especially the funds we've just appropriated, whether it's TEACH grants or infrastructure. If it's needed, we want to be at the table and ready to do that, and I think we are there. So right now, there is no ask of commitment on our behalf.
Representative Felskowski, will the state's next biennial budget, of course we don't know, it's not set yet, but does the Rural Wisconsin Initiative hope to secure funds for its broadband goals?
Well, keep in mind we already did something with that when we redid the TEACH grants. We took and put into the budget Representative Quinn's and Senator Markline's with putting more money into broadband. But after having, you know, Governor Walker did a 72-county tour this summer, and when he put his budget together, there was a huge commitment to broadband. And I don't think it matters who's in, you know, the power, but we know that broadband is an issue. It's almost like if you go back into the 50s when the government said everybody's entitled to electricity, that it's, you know, it's an economic driver, it's a quality of life issue, you know, and we made sure that everybody had electricity and everybody had access to a telephone. This is the same concept that we're working under with broadband. So the investment will be there to get broadband to the residents of the state of Wisconsin.
Representative Quinn, is the Rural Wisconsin Initiative, this focus on broadband, is it working? Are you seeing results?
Oh, absolutely. And I think last session we came out with that legislation to try and up the current existing program, the governor's program, to $10 million. I think some legislators kind of laughed at us. Like, you want to spend $10 million on what? Because as you know, they were letting about $500,000 to $1.5 million a year, and it was done once they reached $6 million. So there was basically, the program was already using up its funds. And now, suddenly, because we started that conversation, we made it aware, people became aware, they started calling their legislators. Again, this we talked before the show, it doesn't matter if you're rural or even urban, everyone in their district has people that don't have access. And pretty soon it became a problem for everybody. And I'm glad to see the governor ran with that in his budget, that momentum there. And we piggybacked off that with our bills in the Rural Wisconsin Initiative to really fine-tune these funds and these programs to make sure we're providing the most access with the limited dollars that we have. And I think we've absolutely made a difference and influence in this state.
Well, Representative Quinn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Representative Mary Felskowski, thank you so much for being a part of the program.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
That was Representative Romaine Quinn. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 75th Assembly District, which includes Rice Lake. Also joining us today was Representative Mary Felskowski. She's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 35th Assembly District, which includes Irma. They joined us today to talk about a new Microsoft pilot program, which will help bring high-speed internet access to rural parts of the state.
Coming up, our guest says millennial bashing, or its historical equivalent, has been around for ages. We'll find out more. Stay with us on Central Time.
In the past few years, millennials have been blamed for ruining cereal, department stores, and jobs.
So, Marathon Industries, give me a breakdown.
It's a B2B company that provides cloud storage for Fortune 500 companies.
Chet, what did the market research turn up?
What? Oh, I Googled them, but the results were weird.
You didn't use the market research database that we spend thousands of dollars a month on and that you were specifically trained to use?
I quit. This job is different than I thought it would be.
Stop. Does this situation look familiar? A new type of worker has entered the workforce. They're called millennials, and they're terrible. Today, I'm going to teach you all about this new breed of worker so you can avoid misunderstandings in which you feel the need to fire them immediately.
And that was a mock training video for how to work with millennials. And our guest says hand-wringing over the next generation is nothing new. Eric Weisgott teaches medieval literature at Boston College, where he's an assistant professor. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Well, as you heard there, there's been ample fodder for either making fun of millennials or bashing millennials for ruining stuff like jobs and the napkin industry. Can you run us through the current climate of millennial bashing in our country?
Sure. What sort of prompted me to think about this was mainly these kinds of hit pieces online and in public discourse about how millennials are supposedly leading to the end of all that is good. I think it's we're in a particular moment where my generation and then also the generation of my students, we're all millennials, are kind of in the crosshairs for a variety of kinds of anxieties.
And like you said, you're a millennial yourself, your students are millennials, and you say, you know, that the stereotype is wrong of millennials as these lazy, narcissistic disruptors. What do you see in millennials?
Yeah, I think the stereotypes are wrong. I think that in my experience with my friends, with my students, I would say the kind of general social context for millennials, we came of age after the Iraq War, after the Great Recession. Basically, what we've seen government fail to do what it ought to do at the highest levels, and we've seen that failure be bipartisan. We've seen it be both parties messing up and leading to destruction. And I think that's like the context for just the way that millennials think about culture and the future.
Well, what you've done is you've taken the long view, the really long view through medieval literature. What do you see there when you look at this kind of intergenerational sniping that's gone on?
Right. So I study medieval literature and teach medieval literature, the oldest literature in English. And really what you find when you look back, even just as far as the 14th century, which is only about halfway back to medieval literature, even in the 14th century, authors are very worried that young people are ruining society. For example, Geoffrey Chaucer, the most famous author that I teach, he is really worried in one of his poems, Troilus and Cressida, that future generations will miscopy the poem, will mismeter it, which is a word he apparently invents for this purpose, so they'll get the meter wrong. He was sincerely worried, it appears, that the future generations just, his accomplishment in poetry would be completely lost because of how language would change and how culture would change.
And he's not alone. You write about a poem called Winner and Waster, and it sounds like there the poet is worried about the pending death of storytelling.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a slightly earlier poem from the 1350s, and it begins by lamenting that the good old days of storytelling are over, that no one appreciates a good story anymore, and especially no one can tell one anymore, that all of these young minstrels who scarcely can even put three words together get praised by rich patrons. So the standard of storytelling has already dropped off by the 1350s.
So young minstrels are always ruining things, right?
Always. Those young hipster minstrels are just ruining things.
And Thomas Malory, he's another person that you cite. You say that he's worried that young people are ruining sex.
Yes, and I thought this was particularly appropriate since several of the hit pieces about millennials talk about how we are supposedly having less sex or having sex in different ways. And Thomas Malory was worried about this in the late 15th century. He compiles the Morte d'Arthur, a collection of stories about King Arthur and his knights. And at one point, he or the narrator of the stories says, nowadays lovers just jump into bed right away. But, quote, but the old love was not so. And he's there talking not about his own generation or an immediately previous generation. He's talking about the 6th century, so about 800, 900 years before he's writing. So he thought that young people of a very long time ago had already ruined sex.
We're talking to Eric Weisgott right now from Boston College, joining us to talk about the history behind millennial bashing. And Eric, is there a tendency, do you think, for people who are doing this kind of generational hand-wringing to romanticize either the present period or maybe the past?
I think there is. I think there's a bit of romanticizing of the past that always goes on. That's a sort of flip side of this. All these medieval authors are doing that as well, especially Malory. He's thinking of this kind of invented knightly, courtly love past for King Arthur that may never have happened, but in the late 15th century, he wants it to have happened. But I think the other side of it is it's also about the future. It's about thinking through current changes in culture and how they might change the future. And my sort of big take on this from looking back at this older writing is simply that we're really just not very good at predicting the future in any regard, even broadly the cultural and social changes that will happen. So I think people are right that that millennials will change culture and society. I don't think that the kind of reaction to younger generations is misplaced, but people are not going to be able to predict exactly how society will change. And these medieval authors are hilariously wrong about what will happen in the future.
Now, one of the more recent examples of sniping at millennials was an Australian, I think it was a businessman, who said that millennials would never be able to buy homes because they were spending their money poorly on avocado toast. Do you see any kind of corollary to that if you look at medieval literature?
Right. That's become, you know, just a complete punchline on social media now. The avocado, you know, money expressed as avocados for millennials. I think that one of my other examples maybe speaks to this. The other major poet from the 14th century in English is William Langland, kind of more shadowy poet who wrote a poem called Piers Plowman. And in that poem, he, somewhat similar to Winner and Waster, he's worried that no one can write poetry anymore and no one can interpret it anymore, and that the people who ought to know the seven liberal arts, quote, fail in philosophy, and that priests who ought to know the mass skip over parts of the mass without letting anyone know. So he's really worried that all these different aspects, aspects of society, the church and poetry, grammar, school, all these are just kind of deteriorating. and they're deteriorating because of lazy young people.
And so, Eric, as a representative right now for a generation of millennials, what do you want older generations to know when they next time they see one of these stories about how millennials are ruining X, Y, or Z? How should we be instead?
Right. I think two things. I think that people older than myself who maybe have more direct memories of, let's say, the fall of the Soviet Union, the Vietnam War, these like major watershed moments in U.S. history, need to remember that is only kind of prehistory for millennials. Important, but not as immediate as our experience of, again, I think 9/11, the bank bailout, and the very, very slow, for some, economic recovery that we're experiencing now. I think those loom larger. And the second thing is, again, that it's not that things aren't changing. I think they are. I think I do sympathize with the impulse to point out changes and kind of weigh them, right? All change isn't good. But I just think the game of trying to predict exactly how these changes will play out in the future is a sort of fool's game. And
Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Eric Weisgott is a medievalist and English professor at Boston College. Joined us to talk about the history behind millennial bashing.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Ken.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Being sick is no fun. For many people, the normal course of action is to trudge to the drugstore and load up on several over-the-counter remedies. But while we may feel as though we're being proactive in our care, a new study shows that we're making mistakes with dosage and sometimes taking the wrong medication, and that's leading to an increase in hospital visits and, in some cases, fatalities.
Henry Spiller joins us now to talk about what we can do to cut down on medication errors. He's the director of the Central Ohio Poison Center in Nationwide Children's Hospital and the co-author of that study. Henry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what were you looking for when you conducted this study?
Well, this is one of the... we thought that it was something that was kind of flying under the radar. These are fairly serious errors, but it's not... occurring in the hospital, this is occurring in people's homes, and we focused on what we referred to as serious medical errors, cases that had relatively serious outcomes.
And how do you define a serious outcome?
In this data, there's an ultimate outcome. There's no effect, minor effect, moderate effect, which is what we call systemic effects, things like rapid heart rate, tachycardia, drop in blood pressure, and major outcomes. And major outcomes are defined as life-threatening and or permanent injury. And so we focus solely on the moderate and major outcomes, the ones that had relatively serious clinical effects.
And you work at a children's hospital. Are you particularly concerned with how these medication errors are affecting kids?
We are. But there's sort of two, you know, we divided it into several groups. The very young children, and in those cases, they're not taking their own medication. They're being given the medication. And so the errors are occurring generally with caregivers, parents, daycare centers, that sort of thing. And then in the older children and adults, they're usually taking their own medication, and so the effort to reach them is a different educational effort.
Right. Let's go over the different types of errors that you found. What sorts of things are people doing wrong?
Again, depends on which age group. In the younger children, these are, again, the caregivers, and it's there's a couple of things. They're getting double doses. Often, say there's a fever and mom gives a medication and dad doesn't know and he comes in and then he gives it. Or in some cases, they're getting the wrong medication. It's a busy night and the younger child gets the older child's medication. You know, it's just, and so we focused on the reason. And in those cases, it whether it was a double dose, whether it was the wrong person's medication, or a measuring error. And in the older adults, there is a couple of reasons, and it really kind of depends on which medication it was. In some cases, it's they forgot to put on their glasses. Many adults, especially as they get older, maybe on 3, 4, in some cases 10 different medications, you know, throughout the day. And it's not unusual for them to be able to, you know, swallow 3 pills or 4 or 5. But if they do that with their heart medication, the calcium channel blockers, that's like a week's dose all at once, and it could be relatively serious. And another sort of typical one is diabetics who are on insulin. You have 2 different doses. You have a dose early in the morning when you're about to be active and ultimately have 3 meals. And so it's a shorter acting insulin, and it's a larger dose. And then in the evening, when you're about to become less active and sleep, there's no more meals left, you have a smaller dose and a longer-acting insulin, but sometimes they mix them up. They're not looking, and they take the much larger dose, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and they're about to go to sleep, and is their blood sugar going to drop? So there's a number of things that we wanted to kind of highlight.
And it's interesting you found that the rate of this kind of medication error, it's increasing. You looked at starting in 2000 and went more than a decade, and the rates have gone up quite a lot.
They have. There's a very significant sort of and steady increase. It's not like a jump in 1 year. And this is likely due to, well, there's a couple of potential reasons. More medications out there. Busier lifestyle in children, you know, trying to manage, say, 2 jobs, kids going to school, a bunch of things. In older adults, as they get older, they tend to be on greater numbers of medications, and there's a greater risk of error. And that's another feature, is that we wanted to let people know that this is both important but increasing.
We're talking to Henry Spiller right now, director of the Central Ohio Poison Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and we're talking about a new study that finds a big rise in medication errors, and we'll be talking about what to do about it as well. And Henry, when we're talking about children, I have a couple of kids myself, and I can tell you that the ways to dose kids, I mean, there's all kinds of different little plastic cups. There are syringes. They're all different sizes. Some are teaspoons. Some are milliliters. How much does that play into this?
That's a good portion of it, and especially in younger children, there's a couple of medications, the over-the-counter medications like cough cold remedies, and fever and sort of pain medications like ibuprofen and Tylenol, where you're right, they come as these liquid preparations, and you can either get a cup. Sometimes the difference between a teaspoon and a tablespoon is TBS or TSP or TBSP, you know, and they make a difference. And if you give them a tablespoon by that little measuring cup, that's actually 3 times the dose they should have gotten. And syringes, we've tried to have them establish that they're just the cup that, or the measuring device, if it's a syringe that comes with that product, that it only have one marker instead of, like, you know, all the 12 different markers that gets people confused, so that device only has one measuring sort of line to go to.
Do you think there should be an industry standard for this kind of thing, that if we're talking about children's over-the-counter medications, there should be one standard for every measuring device you get?
We would like it. One of the problems that's a little difficult is that children get bigger as they grow. And so, you know, a 12-year-old who's 60, 70, maybe 100 pounds is different than a 2-year-old who's only 30 pounds, and the dose might increase. And But if we're talking about doses for children under five, we'd like it to be a single measuring device. Yes.
And what about adults when we're talking about dosage errors? Is it then we're talking more about, you know, kind of operator error types of things they don't put on their reading glasses, or maybe the labeling is confusing?
In these cases, because we focused on the what we call the serious outcomes, there were many others that didn't result in injury. But in this one, we were focusing on the ones with that really had some significant outcomes. And there were three groups that stood out, in the adults especially. The what we call cardiovascular or heart medications for your heart and your blood pressure, and the diabetic medications, and then, and the third one was what we refer to as analgesics or pain medications. And in the adults, those are narcotics, the opioids. And if you take a few extra of those, you can get into real trouble. And again, we focused on errors, not people trying to overdose or abuse these. These are people who just took too many inadvertently. And the opioids can be a real problem. You know, several extra of those and you kind of go to sleep and stop breathing.
Do you think part of it could be that there are simply more of these medications being prescribed now than there were a decade ago?
That's certainly a part of it. There's no question that, you know, that there's more of these out there, or more people on these medications, and so there's more errors. And that is part of what we're trying to address as you have this increased amount out there. We need to focus on the educational effort is you have to be quite careful with these.
So
but I think it's a large part of it. Some people may not recognize how dangerous a few extra of these really are. They are just, their doctor tells them this is for your blood pressure, you know, but they may not be aware of what happens if you take an extra three or four.
Right. So whose job is it to do the educating? Is it the pharmacist or is it the doctor?
I think it's a team effort in each case. Obviously, you know, the initial part of it, you're at the physician's office and I'm going to put you on these medications. And they should let you know this is what it's for. And there's a potential risk if you're dizzy and you stand up, you could, especially in elderly, if your blood pressure drops and you stand up very quickly, you can fall. And that's when we start to see things like broken hips. And so they get admitted to the hospital for a broken hip when, in fact, it was a medication error that put them there. The second step is that when you get your medication filled, generally at the pharmacy, they're going to say, do you have any questions? And that's an additional time to give them some information about this.
Henry Spiller is with us right now. He's the director of the Central Ohio Poison Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and he's with us to talk about a new study that looks at the rise of medication errors.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about over-the-counter medications? Have you ever accidentally taken too much medication or given your child the wrong dose? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're continuing our conversation right now about the rise in medication errors with Henry Spiller. He's director of the Central Ohio Poison Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital.
And you can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you ever accidentally taken too much medicine when you've been sick? What changes would help you when it comes to labeling? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Krista on the line with us in Eau Claire. Krista, hi.
Hi. I was just commenting on my daughter. She was about a year and a half to 2 years old, and she needed a nebulizer for bronchitis or whatever it was at the time. And after about an hour that she got the medication, she was just fidgety and wide awake and just shaking. Mm. And so we called the doctor and the pharmacist, and they ended up, what had happened, they had ended up giving her the adult prescription.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And so, and then they said, well, just cut it in half. And I'm like, no way. She's, just a toddler. I said, I don't feel comfortable, especially with that. So they just gave us a new prescription, and that was it. But, it's kind of scary at that point when you don't know what's going on.
Right. That is scary, Krista. Thank you for calling and sharing that. And what about, Henry, accidents that happen at the pharmacy?
That we do see that, and I have to feel for people. They go to the pharmacy, they're like, here's your medication, and they may be obviously well-educated people, but perhaps not health professionals, so they take for granted that that's what they're supposed to take. And when they get home, like in this case, it's either the wrong dose, in some cases it's the wrong medication. We have seen that. There are efforts to prevent that, but if there is a question, you can always call the poison center. You're going to get an expert immediately. Poison centers only have nurses and pharmacists on the phones, so you're going to get someone immediately who's going to recognize what that medication is, what that dose is, and is this going to get into an area where it might be really dangerous?
Right, and you can use that resource, I suppose, 24 hours a day, is that right?
24/7.
Nice.
And in every state. It's the same number, Wisconsin or, frankly, California or Ohio. Depending on where you call, you get your state's poison center.
Krista, thanks a lot for that and sharing that. I'm glad your daughter was okay after that. And let's go now to John in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to...
I am a registered nurse, and one of our great fears as nurses is that patients don't understand the instructions we give them.
Hmm.
And I had a patient who was in after a heart catheterization. When I discharged him, he was to take his blood center once a day in the evening and his heart stimulant medication twice a day. A week later, they brought him back to the hospital by rescue squad. He was dying almost. He didn't die. But he had been taking the once-a-day medication twice a day and the other medication only once a day. He came back in. His heart was in atrial fibrillation, and his blood was so thin he was nearly hemorrhaging out of every pore in his body.
Oh.
And wow. I learned a lesson about making certain that my patient understand their instructions.
Well, John, how do you do that? How do you make sure your patient understands?
One of the techniques I learned, when I give a patient instructions, I ask them to repeat them to me to make sure they understood. If at all possible, if there's a member of the family around, I want them present as we give the instructions so that they understand what's supposed to happen. Because a lot of patients that come in these days are older folks, and sometimes communication is hard.
And John, is that just you who does that, or is that protocol for all the nurses where you work?
Well, I think we all eventually learn. We have a bad experience like that, and we learn. But it's something we talk about with each other, and it's something that the hospital certainly encourages. Make sure your patient understands.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that. And yeah, you talk about examples like that too, Henry, just what John was getting at there. What about that nurse angle and using that kind of education tool, having the patient repeat it back for starters?
That is great. I really applaud his efforts there. That's going to be for patients being discharged from the hospital. That sounds like his scenario. But in those cases, they're often going home, and something like that would be critical. Also, perhaps adding written information, if there is possible, a table, the green one once a day. But having them repeat it back is really helpful. In some of these cases, they're not going home from the hospital. They're just getting these from their what we call PMD or a private medical doctor's office. But in the case like that where there is direct contact and they're going and they have that, I think his efforts are, I'd love to see him occur everywhere.
John, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your experience. Henry, what do you think about those plastic pill planners? There's one for each day of the week. Do those help people?
They do. They really tend to if there's someone organizing them well. We still get people who unfortunately, I either don't turn on the light or don't put on their glasses or these kind of errors where it's really one of either I'm busy or I just am used to this and I know what I'm doing. I'm not going to turn on the light. But they definitely help reduce these types of errors.
What do you think could help with labeling? So that when people look at the bottle and or the box, whatever it comes in, it's clear and maybe there's one standard for how you write things.
That would be helpful. Unfortunately, I mean, it really would, but in many of these cases, we have people on up to 25 medications. The average is 5 to 6 medications that they're on in the adults. So they have multiple pill bottles, and it's really important for them to make some sort of, like a daily planner or a regimen, so that they're not taking, like the previous description, the two-a-day, once-a-day, and the once-a-day, twice-a-day, and a week later, they find themselves in trouble.
Well, you have some thoughts based on what you found about how people can keep things straight and try to avoid these errors. What do you suggest we do?
Initially, again, it focuses on which age group we're talking about. You know, when we're talking about young children versus adults, in the adults, you know, if it's one or two medications, we have errors here. For instance, there's one medication where you take it once a week, and it's simply the patients didn't understand the instructions, so they get for a 3-month period, they get 12 of these, and 12 days into this, almost 2 weeks into this, they've taken 3 months of it, and they call their doctor and go, I'm out of medication. You're like, how could you be out of medication? You're only supposed to have taken 2 of these. So part of it is again, being really clear on what this is and the instructions. It's a busy life. Some people don't take the time to really focus on this. We want to let them know that there can be significant errors.
Henry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Henry Spiller is the director of the Central Ohio Poison Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital, with us there to talk about the growing rate of people making dosing mistakes when they take their medicine, maybe for themselves or maybe for that dose of pain reliever that they're giving to their children. Maybe they're a daycare center or co-parenting. And also we're looking there at the medical dangers that can come from that. You can let us know what you think on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can call it the official song of summer, and it's made history. People have streamed this song 4.6 billion times over the past 6 months.
The infectious song is called Despacito by Puerto Rican stars Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee, and it features a remix by none other than the Biebs, Justin Bieber.
While Despacito was a bona fide global hit prior to Bieber getting involved, it generated relatively little interest in the U.S. music scene, but when Universal Music re-released the song with an English introductory verse by Justin Bieber, that's when Despacito found its way onto the American pop charts.
We had a little Despacito party in the office earlier today.
Especially with one producer at the helm.
Right. I had managed somehow not to hear it, and we sampled both the original and the Biebs version. And I gotta say, I like the Biebs version.
Got it. We got up to speed.
Here it is. Turn every situation into heaven, yeah. Oh, you are my sunrise on the darkest day. Got me feeling some kind of way. Make me want to savor every moment slowly, slowly.
fit me, tailor me, love how you put it on. Got the only key, know how to turn it on. The way you never lie, my ear, the only words I wanna hear. Baby, take it slow so we can last long.
Tú eres el imán y yo soy el metal. Me voy acercando y voy armando el plan. Solo con pensarlo se acelera el pulso.